The Institute for the Humanities at Salado presents Understanding Vietnam. Tape code 3-48-82, address The Second Indochina War, Vietnam Reexamined. Speaker General Douglas Kennard.
And when you come back to introduce the next speaker, I'm very happy to introduce General Douglas Kennard. I've had the pleasure of talking to him on the telephone, and it's really very nice to meet you in person and to have you here. He will present his significant views on a segment of the Vietnam War in which he was intimately involved. When I was trying to decide whom to invite to represent the military, I talked to Maxwell Taylor, and Maxwell Taylor, without any hesitation, the first person he said, get Doug Kennard if he will accept. And we're grateful that he did. General Kennard served in the Army during World War II as Special Assistant to General Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander. He served in Korea. He served in Vietnam as one-time Chief Operations Analyst. He is a distinguished and much decorated general, and I'm sure you've read his biographical material in the Yellow Book, which is very impressive. He is now a professor of political science at the University of Vermont. His books include The War Managers, an analysis of the views of 173 generals. His book, The Secretary of Defense, an analysis of five Secretaries of Defense. A book on President Eisenhower called A Study in Defense Tradition. And a book to be published by W.W. Norton entitled The Second Indochina War, the subject with which he will speak to us today. General Kennard, I welcome you, and I'm grateful you're here.
Thank you. Thank you, Harry, for a very kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to attend this important symposium and really a distinct privilege to have the opportunity to address you. I guess there's no question, at least in my mind, that the Vietnam War was the greatest failure in American foreign policy in our time, quite apart from the devastation, disruption, human suffering, and waste of resources that were entailed. I think, therefore, that the Institute here at Salado is to be commended for its success in bringing together this group of participants in an attempt to dispassionately try to understand what actually happened as much as we can. Now, you're going to be exposed to a great variety of points of view in this program, which is all to the good. And what I will attempt to do in my 45 minutes is to build on the very fine historical background which George Herring's talk set, and to re-examine the military aspects of the war from the summer of 1965 onward. Specifically, I want to structure my talk along three things. First, I want to very briefly set a strategic framework to which we'll return at the conclusion in order to draw some lessons or infer some lessons from what I've said. And second, and mainly, I want to examine the ground war in the South from two points of view, at the outset from the objectives themselves, what it was we perhaps were trying to accomplish, and secondly, at a somewhat greater length, the actual conduct of the war itself to meet these objectives. And then finally, as time permits, to go to the withdrawal phase, the so-called Vietnamization phase, from 1969 to 1972. So first, some comments on strategic concepts. I'm not trying to be a college professor on this, but I think we have to set up kind of a framework to which we can return and sort out the lessons at the end. Strategy has many definitions, but I think from our point of view, since we're looking at the Second Indochina War, I would just really like to briefly state what the Joint Chiefs of Staff definition of strategy was in 1965 when they embarked upon the war. Is the art and science of developing and using the political, economic, psychological power of a nation together with its military forces to secure national objectives. Whereas the military force is the part that I'm going to speak about in the main, but not exclusively, is just one element of total strategy. Now, with that in mind, what I'd like to set forth for your consideration is what I would call the dimensions of strategy. And then I'm going to return to these at the very end, as I said before, for the lessons. The first of these dimensions is the operational. the movement of armed forces to overcome the armed forces of the enemy, the dimension that we usually think of. The classical example, of course, of all of our reading was Napoleon. Decisive battle is achieved by maneuver and fire, and that's what war was all about. That's one dimension. The second dimension, one we don't like to talk about so much, but an important dimension, is logistical. And I guess the classical example of that in our country is the Civil War, where Lee's maneuvering of the Army of Northern Virginia, one of the five great Western armies of all time, was decisively defeated by Grant, because Grant wore him down by a logistical strategy, which in the end was overpowering. The third dimension of strategy, and these last two we don't really talk so much about, but the third dimension of strategy I would call a socio-psychological, that began to appear late in the 19th century and became more evident in World War I and later. In World War I, decisions obviously could not be reached by a purely operational basis. It was increasingly logistical, to be sure, but the home front had to be mobilized, and that became the key factor. It was the society with the weakest will, that would collapse first. And one gets the impression of this in that greatest of all World War I novels, in the final chapter, All Quiet on the Western Front, the poignant impressionistic sense of the collapse of the German home front. Finally, there's a managerial dimension of strategy, including but going beyond questions of organization and leadership, and in our society, into the very fabric of civil-military relations, which is all central to understanding certain aspects of the Second Indochina War. Now, I'll not further bring up the logistical dimension, but in the end, I'll talk on the other three and try to draw some lessons. Let me close this very brief excursion into strategy with a quote from Clausewitz, that great 19th century author of On War, because I think it's a particularly pertinent quote to what we're talking about here in strategic terms. War can never be separated from political intercourse, and if this occurs, we have before us a senseless thing without an object. It's Clausewitz on War. Let's turn then now to the strategy as it developed in the South between 1965 and 1968. Now, the initial goal of the U.S. forces was, of course, as brought out very well in Dick Ellison's movie last evening, to hold the country together. And to do this, it was necessary, of course, in the preliminary stages to push the ARV and the Army of Vietnam out of the way and move in the U.S. forces. The Battle of the River Drong, the Ia Drong, if you want to use the Montagnard dialect, which was described last night, was the first great illustration of that. October 1968, November 1968, the Drong River had its one moment in history. And it was an important moment for all of us in determining the strategy of the war. It's a test of mobility and firepower of the United States versus the manpower and choice of terrain of the North Vietnamese. And of course, you know how it came out. It derailed Hanoi's hopes of an early victory, and it perhaps gave us some feelings of assurance that we might not have, should not have in retrospect, have held. Now, after the success of this counterattack, and of course the Ia Drong was only one element of it, but the key element of it, after the success of this counterattack, the goal became somewhat different. The goal became one of defeating the enemy, winning. But winning is not the same as not losing. And what then was the strategy that was adopted, and how is it adopted to fight the war from the point on where we held the enemy and we were going then to go to win or to defeat the enemy, however you wish to put it? Well, there wasn't any grand plan, that's for sure. You can read all the grand words in the Pentagon Papers, the JCS documents, and so forth, but they were essentially air. Rather, there were a series of programs developed essentially in Vietnam, but also worked over a little bit in Washington, which involved troop increases and certain specific objectives to be accomplished. Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, was directly involved in the approval not only of these forces as they incrementally developed over a period of six different programs, but also the objectives that were attached to them. An excellent illustration of this way of setting forth military objectives, I think, is set forth in a Honolulu meeting of February 1966. This is one, by the way, when you talk to Westmoreland, he always goes back to as the basis from which he got his specific objectives in the war in Vietnam. This was the meeting where the Key Johnson Declaration, placing emphasis on economic and sociological programs, was announced. Pacification, if you wish. But the real document of importance, at least from the point of view of Westmoreland, who was, after all, the ground commander in Vietnam, was a two-page document which he was to use as his guidance for strategy in that key year of 1966, immediately following the events of the Yia Drang, which were alluded to earlier. Was this drafted by the Joint Chiefs of Staff? No, not at all. It was drafted basically by Bill Bundy, who you saw on the screen last night, who was Assistant Secretary for State Far East. John McNaughton, I don't believe he was on the screen, who was in the Pentagon ISA, presumably approved by McNamara and Rusk, but it was what Westmoreland took as a takeoff point in this war. Let me give you some, just a flavor of some of the objectives. There were many. I just wanted to give you four to get you a feeling of what the ground commander was going on in Vietnam when he developed the strategy. Conduct intensified offensive operations against enemy forces, doubling the number of battalion months from 40 to 75 a month. That's not so much an objective as it is an effort, but that's the way these things were worded. Increase the destruction of Viet Cong, North Vietnamese base areas, more about that later, from 10% to 40 or 50%. Now, what did that mean? Who knows? The base area is destroyed, and eventually, of course, it's reoccupied again. At what point in time have you reached 40%? No. Ensure the defense of all military bases and population centers now under government control. Finally, and here's the one that's going to play a part in our story a little bit later, a trip by year's end, VC North Vietnamese forces at a rate as high as their capability to put men in the field, is the origin of what became the central goal in the strategy in Vietnam. Now, in 1974, I was alluded to, I did a survey of the generals who commanded in Vietnam. And one of the questions I asked them was, how clear were these objectives that you received directly from Westmoreland, indirectly from the Defense Department and elsewhere? And here are some of the comments. We intervened with no clear idea of where we're headed. Play it by ear. The objective was never clear to anyone. The U.S. was committed to a military solution without a firm military objective. The policy was attrition, killing VC. This offered no solution. It was senseless. These are not taken specifically to give you a certain impression. These are the kind of comments I got, 40 or 50 I could read to you, somewhat along the same line. Of perhaps more important, 70% of the generals queried about these objectives for the war in their answer said they were uncertain of the objectives of the war. Now, this mirrors a deep-seated strategic failure. It is possible for 70% of the privates to be unsure of the objectives of the war, but 70% of the generals to be unsure of the objectives of the war in which they were fighting? I would say somehow they had not, the word had not gotten through, if indeed there was a word. All right, now let's turn from the objectives and their fuzziness, although they're, in a grand sense, there were objectives. I'm not saying that, but when you get down to the fighting war. Now to the actual conduct of the war itself. How then did Westmoreland conduct the war based upon his perception of these objectives, and particularly in that important year of 1966, which set the stage for later? Well, first of all, we must return again, for better or worse, to something that's been alluded to at least twice and will probably be alluded to again, the so-called constraints policy. Now, there were many constraints, and we don't need to get into all of them. There were places you could fire and couldn't fire. There were, you could use this herbicide or not that herbicide. But in a more strategic, if we want to call it that, sense, the constraint that had the most powerful force in governing the strategy was the territorial constraint. The fact that military forces, for better or worse, for the China syndrome or whatever reason, could not operate in North Vietnam, perhaps understandable. The fact that was a little less understandable, they could not operate in Laos and Cambodia until the very late stages of the war. This was a constraint that the ground commander had to face. All right, given this constraint, that the war then must be fought in South Vietnam, point of view of the ground commander, given the missions that he had received, which were rather technical in nature, when one compares, for example, to Eisenhower's mission in World War II, you will enter the continent of Europe and in combination with Allied forces, drive to the heart of Germany and destroy the German armed forces, period. It's a mission Eisenhower operated on in World War II. When you look at that and compare these 40% of the base areas and 16% of that and threading that, we have descended into a different situation, quite understandably. So he had these constraints then across the border. How did he do it? Well, he really set up a three-tier strategy, the key of which was the American forces, the mobility, the firepower, which had demonstrated at the Iedron, in which other forces had perhaps not quite as good as that particular division, but close to it, was what he counted on. Now, what you had to do in that war is you could not go to an area and occupy it throughout the country. It was impossible. It would take 1 million troops, given the terrain, to occupy that. So he developed a situation where he had to go to an area where the enemy was, seek them out, and leave the area. There could never be enough troops to occupy. And this, of course, was the growth of the notion of search and destroy, as contrasted to the historic notion of seize and hold. You seize territory and hold it, remain there. You couldn't do that in Vietnam, obviously. It was impossible. So you search and destroy, not a very nice term, perhaps, but that was a term that was applied to it. It connotes other things that were not really part of it. But now, of course, given that search and destroy, given the employment of American forces to find these major units, this was a jungle-type strategy, a strategy out from the populated areas where the base areas of the major North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces. This was how the American forces were employed in this stage of the war. Now, of course, we have already admitted one thing implicitly without saying it, is given that situation of constraints, given this use of American forces, the enemy has the initiative. When the enemy wants to go back across the border, he goes back across the border. So in this particular strategy, the enemy has the initiative in the larger sense of the word. Once he's caught somewhere, of course, he doesn't have any initiative. But in the broader sense, he has the initiative. There were many operations of this nature. Let me just mention one just to give you the flavor of it. We could talk about a dozen of them. One of the more famous ones is the so-called Cedar Falls operation. There is an area in Vietnam about 20 miles north of Saigon shaped like that called the Iron Triangle. And it was a triple jungle canopy, a network of things. January 1967, Westmoreland sent two divisions, two separate brigades. This is the thing where the village of Ben Sock, the article which written on that. And the place was destroyed, never again to be occupied, right, wrong. It was destroyed, but it was reoccupied later on and used in connection with the Tet 1968 offensive that we'll get to. So it was a very difficult kind of strategy, but the only one he really felt he had. Okay, the second and third tiers of the strategy involved really, and I'm simplifying this a little bit, you can find exceptions to this, really involved not American forces, but Vietnamese forces. The regular Vietnamese forces would be in a security tier. Beyond the Americans operating against the main units toward the borders would be the Arvin forces who would be protecting, in effect, the pacification work, which was what it was supposed to be all about. And back in there were the local militia forces working around with in their own areas on pacification. So it was a three-tiered strategy in which the American firepower and mobility gave it the key role in terms of destroying the enemy forces. Well, given these kinds of constraints and given this kind problem of a strategy, how do you measure progress in something like this? How do you know how well you're doing? You know, in a linear war, it's fairly easy, isn't it? There are geographical goals that you can see. In World War II, our goal when we landed in Normandy was to be at the line of the Seine River. Some of you participated in that, at D plus 90 days. And if we were there, we were on time. As it happened, we were ahead of that. If we were ahead of it, we were ahead of progress. We weren't there, we had to change the strategy or do something about it. But how do you measure progress when 40-50% of the base areas are treading the enemy, this kind of thing? How is the ground commander supposed to know whether his strategy is working or not? Well, there was invented a series of indicators called the measurement of progress system. Gives a connotation of a upward curve on a sort of a linear basis. I don't know what progress is in war, but it's not linear, I'll tell you. What are the indicators of it? Well, the indicators are control of certain areas, control of roads. But what's the most important indicator in a war of attrition? It's kill ratio, isn't it? Body count. A war of attrition is a war of bodies. That's the attrition. And there's also another attrition, which we'll get to later. Now, it was then in this context that the war seemed to be progressing very well throughout 1966 and 1967 in the measurement of all of these indicators. Some became suspicious as to the credibility of some of the indicators, particularly the key indicator. Nonetheless, it seemed that by 1967, this strategy was working. And it was only going to be a period of time before that key point. In fact, that point had been assumably reached in the summer of 67, where more enemy were being killed than were able to be introduced into the country, the so-called crossover point. And this allegedly happened in the summer of 67. So that by the fall of 67, then, we could say, notwithstanding the constraints, and given all of this American power and a sort of what seemed to be an improvement in the Arvin forces, that we were, in fact, reaching these specific kinds of goals which have been given in Honolulu and later modified, of course, to some extent in detail, which we don't need to bother with. And, in fact, the year-end report, I will quote to you, Morris Mullen's report, December 1967, we'd really reached the peak, not in numbers, but in quality of our forces there, reached the peak, and we reached pretty high numbers. And the war was being actively conducted. Quote, in many areas, the enemy has been driven away from the population centers. In others, he has been compelled to disperse and avoid contact. The year ended with the enemy resorting to desperation tactics to achieve military psychological victory, and he's experienced only failure in these attempts. December 1967, the high point. And then the bubble broke. In the early morning hours of January 30th, 1968, the Tet 1968 offensive. But let's go back a little bit before we talk about that offensive and see what Hanoi had in mind. They, of course, read the indicators fairly carefully. They understood what was happening in terms of people being killed. They understood the superior American manpower. But they also understood, as George brought out very well earlier, that they wanted to win. So, planning began the previous summer, the summer of 1967, before Tet 68. What to do about this? Giap, our old friend who had beaten the French at Dien Bien Phu, had a Dien Bien Phu of his own mind, somewhat different, which he wanted to apply to the Americans. And he made certain assumptions, both about the United States and about South Vietnam, in developing the strategy. As far as the United States is concerned, he made three assumptions. One, that the U.S. strength would not be noticeably increased over what it was then. That proved to be essentially correct. The programs then in the works were essentially the final programs with some addition. Second, that the constraints on the employment of American forces geographically would not be removed. And this he proved essentially correct until much later. Third, and his key assumption, was that anti-war sentiment in the U.S. was a powerful political force in an election year and could be decisive in the outcome of the war. He was not far-fetched in this assumption. Perhaps he overstated it a little bit, but he wasn't far-fetched. Strangely enough, the other two assumptions had to do with the South Vietnamese, and in those he proved wrong in both cases. His first assumption was that the South Vietnamese army would not fight when faced with a major offensive on his part, which he has coming in his mind. Proved wrong on that. Second, that the people would rise up, there would be a general uprising if the Viet Cong, North Vietnamese indicated some success, on their behalf. And this he proved wrong. So his assumptions about the Americans proved fairly accurate. His assumptions about the South Vietnamese proved, at least at that moment, inaccurate in terms of 1967, 1968. Now, what was the plan that he came up with? He came up with, to simplify a very complex plan, with a two-tiered plan. One, he would, beginning in the fall of 1967 and continuing through peaking in January 1968, early January, he'd have a series of diversionary tactics along the border areas, particularly at a place called Khe San, up in the north, in which he would draw both American attention and American interest and American resources as a sort of a strategically diversionary thing. True, it would be expensive in manpower. And as we'll see in a moment, it was extremely expensive in manpower for him. But Giap, and this is an accurate quote, "The life or death of 100 or 1,000 or tens of thousands of human beings, even if they're our own compatriots, represents very little." In terms of the goals to be achieved, that was irrelevant. Whereas he had a public opinion to face, obviously, but it was not quite as constraining as his opponents had to face. Thank God. The second part of the goal, having conducted this diversion against the Americans, because those are the people who, in the search and destroy, went out to meet these main force units in the main, was a simultaneous attack, although it didn't quite work out that way for obvious reasons of coordination. But it did work out fairly substantially, a simultaneous attack to be conducted on the first day of the Lunar New Year, Tet 1968, January 30th, 1968, local time, against a large number of provincial capitals. There were 44 provinces in South Vietnam at that time, and it did occur within a day or two in 36 of them, in almost all of the autonomous cities, Saigon, Da Nang, and so forth, and it did occur in 5 out of 6 of those, and in many district capitals as possible, and ended up in 64 of the 240 district capitals, and about 50 hamlets. All of this was to be conducted as a psychological demonstration against this great progress which the Americans had said they had. Westmoreland's report of December 1967 had been given public notice by Lyndon Johnson's recalling him in a moment where he needed his support to show the war was going well. In November 1967, Westmoreland gave all these statistics, gave this great progress before, among other places, the National Press Club. This was in the minds of the Americans as they turned on their TV sets on 30th of January and the 1st of February, 1968. The Tet Offensive, then, of 1968 was an audacious plan, stunningly executed, and vast in its repercussions. It was the high point in military action in the Second Indochina War. After all other battles have been forgotten, it will be remembered. Nothing else was ever the same again in the war. It represented a tremendous military defeat for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese in a technical sense, but it was a tremendous psychological victory for them in the United States. It was the Dien Bien Phu of the Second Indochina War, Tet 1968. What Dien Bien Phu had done to the French home front, with some alteration, Tet 1968 did to the American home front. Americans looked at TV, they couldn't believe what they were saying. All those years of enemy body counts, all this progress, and a bunch of kids in sneakers are running around the American embassy. Of course, they really weren't. They were just psychologically running. In none of these cities did they hold very long, these province capitals, maybe only long enough to run up a flag and take it down. Nevertheless, they paid a tremendous price. The Viet Cong, not by accident, bore the brunt of the action. 40,000 killed. Whole generations of guerrillas wiped out, never to be replaced. The infrastructure was increasingly had to be taken up by North Vietnamese. But in America, it brought down the house. You know the rest of the story, I think, on Tet, LBJ's abdication speech of March 31st, the beginning of the end of the bombing in the North. Negotiations were begun in May and later on, and a little more definite. And then after the election, the new strategy, Vietnamization. This is also an important part of the American strategy in the South, which I would like to turn to now. There's a different strategy than the one that I've outlined somewhat. The 1968 presidential campaign, of course, which came in the wake of all that I've just mentioned. Tet 68, Johnson's abdication, beginning of the negotiations, the curtailment of the bombing in the North, comes the campaign of 1968. Candidate Richard Nixon runs on a plan, quote, he has a plan to get us out of Vietnam. The plan turned out to be somewhat embryonic when he actually got into office. At least no one could find it. And so one of the first steps upon assuming office was to send out a document to the entire national security community called NISM 1, National Security Study Memorandum Number 1, which listed some 28 questions about Vietnam, authored by Henry Kissinger.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over and continue on side two.
And coordinated, the replies came back to the White House. It was serious business from their point of view. This was not to be done in a normal staff procedure. The outcome was in April, and it was a two-tiered strategy. One was, of course, the desirable strategy that everyone, including LBJ, Kennedy, Eisenhower, would have liked had they been able to achieve it. Now, when we talk about negotiation in Vietnam, let's remember we're talking about two things. We're talking about the formal negotiations in Paris, aren't we? Where we discuss the shape of the table and things like that. Then we talk about the actual negotiations, which are done usually with Le Ducteux in a villa somewhere in the same general area with Kissinger on a more episodic basis. So we're talking about a negotiation, but a real negotiation and a sort of a formal negotiation. That's Kissinger's problem. The other goal was the so-called Vietnamization, which was the responsibility of the Secretary of Defense, Melvin Laird. The meaning of Vietnamization was basically to replace Americans with Vietnamese, returning Vietnam back to the Vietnamese in terms of military forces, in terms of supplying them and gearing them up to the effort. And there was a lot of effort put into it. It seemed to be going pretty well at first. By 1969, 1970, the American military forces began to get away from the sort of main force war, began to push into the strategy more and more. It was a low point from the point of view of the North. They were still recovering. But the program was viewed, of course, with skepticism by many senior South Vietnamese. I can recall having luncheon the day before I left Vietnam, 1970, for the last time with a South Vietnamese general who said to me, this has no chance of, you're just cutting and running and that's it. There's no chance of working. So there was some skepticism. But there was a bureaucratic success achieved, and it was an important one in getting American troops out with the realities of Nixon's promise to be out by 72. He had to meet that promise. And Vietnamization, if negotiation didn't work, then Vietnamization would work. It was a double-track thing. And I must say that Melvin Laird's main ally in this was the American commander in Vietnam who'd replaced Westmoreland Abrams. And that we owe Laird a great debt in civil-military relations, that there was never an Algerian syndrome, there was never a stab in the back thing that grew up in the American officer corps, and much of that, and I'm not a personal friend of Laird's, much of that we can attribute to Melvin Laird. There were, however, in the course of this, more appropriate to my subject this morning, three military actions in which there is a lesson of what's going to happen. There were three major military actions, and each of them, in retrospect, it wasn't fully clear at that time, has a lesson which plays a part in the future. The first of these was the Cambodian incursion of May 1970. You know the storyline from George's book and other reading of the situation in Cambodia. The Long Nal government overthrows Sihanouk. There's a political opportunity. The North Vietnamese are getting more aggressive in the country. The U.S. military for years had wanted to cross the border and get at those supplies. And now it could be rationalized on the basis that this would help Vietnamization. Bringing that stuff down the Ho Chi Minh Trail would take months and months to replace. And therefore, technically, let's go in and destroy it. And we did in our area. Two of us here are involved. I was the chief planner in the area, and General Shoemaker here was the chief operator, took the major force across. And we were successful, technically, in that effort. But as you know, what happened in the United States politically was another matter. But for our purposes, the one lesson I want to draw is not all of that. I don't want to relive the Cambodian incursion. Was the important role of U.S. forces. Didn't really realize at the time, I don't think, how much the ARVN, who in their own right were very successful in Cambodia, depended upon American firepower. How important American air and firepower was to them, I don't think quite sensed at that time how vital it was to them. The second military action of the three during this period of Vietnamization, these 4 years of Nixon, was something called Lam Son 719 in February 1971. All ARVN operations were called Lam Son, which means total victory. 719 happened to be a particular operation. It was an incursion up in the northern part of South Vietnam into Laos to cut the trail, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And initially, when American support was there, it was successful. But once American support was removed again, the success was not there and they had to withdraw. It was their last offensive operation. The third and final one, the so-called Easter Offensive of 1972, initiated by North Vietnam in a kind of a conventional war, both coming mainly from the north but also somewhat from the west, an open warfare, again, the B-52 proved decisive. This was the thing that really turned them back. Now, they were allowed to keep some territory there, of course, as the Accords went on. So that was the final military action of the second, of our part of the Second Indochina War. The lesson of all three was quite clear. Without U.S. firepower support, the ARVN could not handle the North Vietnamese offensively or defensively, but then I don't think anyone who knew what was going on ever really thought they could. Okay. Well, the Easter Offensive is the last military action. As you know, it merged with the Accords, which finally came after the Christmas spasm bombing in January and the final removal of U.S. forces. Let me return then to the dimensions of strategy, which I outlined at the beginning, and see what lessons we might infer under the three headings in a sort of an impressionistic sense. Given the vastness of the subject, some of these lessons are going to be extrapolations. That is to say, I'm not proving them in geometric fashion, but I've inferred from a detailed study of this season. First, on the operational dimension, it seems to me, and we're talking, of course, about the military conduct of the war in my section here, that there was a lack of clarity concerning our objectives, which is crippling to any military operational effort. A lack of clarity of objectives. Second lesson concerns fighting a war of attrition, especially one in which the enemy has the initiative, which in this sense he did, in a sense that he could decide when to commit to battle and when not to. Okay, a war of attrition is primarily a war of wills, not a war of power. And that's the war we fought. But the problem is that we had the power and they had the will. So we fought in his dimension. Okay. The second general area of lessons, I would say, in the socio-psychological area, dimension, what I called it, this was alluded to, I think, in passing earlier in one of George's replies to one of the questions. We remembered all the lessons of Vietnam except one. And they were all wrong. We remembered all the lessons of Korea, save one, and they were all wrong. The forgotten lesson, which we did not remember, which was not wrong, was the fragility and non-homogeneous nature of American society. This can be a strength as well as a weakness. I'm not being critical. I'm just saying it's a dimension. Americans simply can't handle a long war inconclusive in results whose objectives are not clear. It has to be a crusade of a World War I or World War II variety to go on for that length of time, and American public opinion simply was not considered by those who actually planning the war in the South, that is those in Saigon. Now, they said it wasn't their business to include American public opinion, and probably technically that's correct, American domestic public opinion. But they were the people planning the war. American public opinion was up to people in Washington, but they weren't planning the war in reality, in the way in which it developed. The second of the two lessons in the socio-psychological dimension I would mention is the role of the media. This was a new dimension to deal with, the role of the media in Vietnam, especially television. Part-time viewing of an event continuing for many years has to depend on some kind of sensationalism. I mean, maybe the war was all about a pig farm in Haonia province, but you can't really show that on television on prime time. Has to be something a little more exciting than that, and therefore the war has to be portrayed in a certain way. Let me put it another way. Ask yourself if we'd had television in World War II, which was a crusade-type war of a different type. Let's suppose there had been television crews sending live broadcasts from Omaha Beach on D-Day, June 6, 1944, 26th Infantry Regiment, Assault Regiment of 1st Infantry Division, on a force of 3,000, on the evening of D-Day, called for 70 officer and 800 enlisted replacements. Now, what kind of impact would that make day in and day out? Now, I'm not being critical of it. I'm saying the media must be taken as a given in future planning. You've got to accept it. It's there. It's part of the planning. You've got to adopt that. But no one simply realized what the impact of this was going to be in terms. It's got to be taken into account in the strategy. It's a given. You can't do anything about it. You can't censor it. It's going to be there. But you got to take it into account when you're deciding the kind of war you're going to fight and the duration you're going to fight. That's all. Okay, the third, the managerial dimension, the only other one I want to talk about, is perhaps we could best view the managerial dimension of the war through the pivotal position of the Secretary of Defense. This is the interface between the military and civilian, and this is where the key decisions were made and are made in connection with wars. Now, let's admit, as previously brought out on several occasions, the domestic constraints on McNamara based on presidential perceptions. Great society dominated Johnson's thinking, we've heard that. No public debate. This meant no debate on the reserve call-up and actual dissimulation on the size of the budget for about 6 months. Now, while certain constraints on the conduct of the war itself were based on genuine concern about the reactions of the Chinese and Soviet, there also a need to avoid public debate on that, getting involved in North Vietnam, and crossing the borders. Hence, when the senior military complained, as they do, or did, about constraints in the conduct of the war and attributed them to inexperienced civilians, which Westmoreland does in his book, Soldier Reports, they're correct in one way, but maybe not correct in the way that they meant. Inexperience there was. But it caused the Defense Secretary, in my opinion, to give the military too much leeway in how the war was fought rather than too little. From June 65 onward, Westmoreland was pretty much in a position to fight the kind of war he wanted within Vietnam, within the constraints policy, pretty much as he wished. Now, in time, McNamara became disenchanted with the military approach in Vietnam, but he really wasn't willing to pay the price of speaking out against the ground commander. So Westmoreland's autonomy in the actual conduct of the war was fairly complete. Further, any lack of meaningful guidance from Washington, as contrasted to specific objectives, could also be interpreted by Westmoreland as approval with the way he was conducting the war. This contrasts with the air war, which is a separate story where there were very tight controls on it from Washington. So therefore, when Westmoreland writes that there are too many constraints imposed by civilians, maybe he's correct in one sense. But in another perspective, you can draw another conclusion. There was not enough civilian participation in terms of asking the big questions about what we were really doing in Vietnam, what we were really going to do with this next troop increase, and so forth. Well, let me just make one final point then, and I'm finished here. My approach has been restricted, of course, to the military aspects of the war, because that's what Harry wanted me to talk about, and has been somewhat analytical within the time frame that we have. However, I would just like to make one point, that the sense of waste and loss which Vietnam conveys to me personally, I think is best summed up in a poem by an English poet, Auden, wrote a poem, Epitaph on the Defeat of the Spanish Republic. History to the defeated may say alas, but it cannot help or pardon. Thank you very much.
Now we'll take a few moments for questions and raise your hand, and the men with the microphones will come to you. State clearly into the microphone your question and give your name. And I want to say I was very enlightened in a way about the military situation that I never really realized before. And I would like to ask General Shoemaker if he would want to comment at the beginning of the questions or ask any questions. Speedy, can we have a microphone here for General Shoemaker?
Thank you, Harry. Well, first I want to congratulate my colleague and old comrade in arms on a good presentation, as the one preceding. I thought was a brilliant rundown of the historical roots and evolution. There's very little that I would disagree with, and I think in the time allotted, General Kennard has made a number of key points. I think if I would emphasize one thing, it's the difficulty of an army, and taking small units and large, doing their business without clear objectives, and that point was made as well as it could be made, but also the strength of squads and platoons and companies flows from the country. And the difficulty that this creates for lieutenants and sergeants and captains and even generals when celebrities and political leaders, no matter how sincere and well, are visiting the capital of the opponent, and the very visible and sincere and questioning and protests in this country, an army cannot be much better and more cohesive and more coherent than the country. And that was indelibly in my three, I served in Vietnam, 62, 63, 65, 66, and 69, 70, and I did command the incursion into Cambodia. And as I have reflected, as all of us have on this, from the purely technical problem of how to get people, men and women, to perform the terrible, terrible feats that must be performed on a battlefield. Number one, I agree, Sherman was right. War is hell. There is no such thing, in my judgment, as a nice little war. And the other thing is, if our country once finds that our interests require us to go to war, I pray to God, first of all, that never happens in the future, but if it does, that there be a national consensus with very clear strategic national objectives, which must be the backdrop against which military objectives are selected. And in Vietnam, we did not have those with the clarity. Well, they were not clear at all.
Could I make an observation here? General Kinnear, can I be heard?
Oh, yes, sir. Yep, go ahead.
Walt Rostow.
I'm Walt Rostow. I wouldn't have believed that such a coherent and, in my view, essentially accurate account of events was possible in that short time period. You heard, I think, a truly brilliant paper. There are a few things I'd like to observe. I wholly agreed at the time, as well as in retrospect, that fighting the war inside Vietnam was unbearably slow way to fight the war, indecisive, costly to the peoples of Southeast Asia, including the North Vietnamese, costly to the people of the United States, Australia, and of the world, to which this was a protracted agony. I had in my office in the State Department a 1962 interview with Pham Van Dong, carried it to the White House, and I have it in my office now, in the Saturday Evening Post, in which he told that brilliant French journalist, what was his name, Bernard Fall, Americans don't like long, indecisive wars. This will be long and indecisive, and therefore we shall win. And I think behind it is something I've never written because I cannot be sure. But it's an important case, I think, of a false analogy between Korea and what happened when we marched the Yalu. I think there would have been no problems at all if we'd put U.S. forces and blocked the trails across Laos, which, in my view, might well have been decisive. In justice to Westy and to others, I think it's worth clarifying the point about optimism in November. At just the time the President brought Westy and Bunker home to talk about the progress made since 65, towards the end of November, it was concluded in Saigon and Washington that a maximum effort would be made, that they had decided they'd been losing ground and would make this effort. That was why the men were flown out, 10,000, I believe it was, General Kinnear, starting in the last week of November. And we were so solid about this that I sent I asked the deputy ambassador, Mr. Locke, when he was in Washington, to get an assessment not of the coming offensive, we knew about that, to summarize that and ask the question, if they were set back, would it be possible for negotiations? And while he was doing his end-of-year report, which you quoted, Westy also on the 21st of December wrote an extremely prescient cable anticipating the coming offensive. And I was with President Johnson when he was out talking to the Australian cabinet on the 21st of December, explaining to them when they asked about a bombing halt in negotiations, he said, we're going to have a dark winter, kamikaze tactics, a maximum effort, and then negotiations might be possible. There was a gross failure here, which President Johnson discusses in his book, a failure on his part, not fully to share the intelligence he had with the American people as he had with the Australian cabinet. The reasons are the inhibitions which are built into the U.S. government, which should have been violated, the inhibitions against telling the enemy what you know. On the other hand, General Wheeler made a speech out at the Detroit Economic Club, and there were briefings in Saigon about the coming offensive. So I would hold the commander-in-chief partly responsible for not preparing the American people for this convulsive maximum effort, which was set back, but which was misunderstood. The other fault lay with the media's interpretation of it. Another point is that it was not part of your brief, General Kennard. I do think that it's important to underline that the Vietnam 69, 70, all the years up to 75, down to the very end, was very different from the one in 65. There was a great deal of nation building in that period, whether you look at quality of administration, the quality of the army, the economy, an agricultural revolution, a land reform, and it's important that we not be left with the implication that there was not serious nation building. And I say this as one who spent 30 years of his life, his major interest in public policy has been economic development and nation building in the developing world. And in my judgment, if we had seen it through, South Vietnam would have moved the way South Korea has. In fact, during the war, it was much more advanced than South Korea was during the Korean War. Finally, you left out elements that I would regard, going back to Dr. Wilmer's words, as true horror, a dark side of America, and inhumanity, which was the action in 1975 of the Congress in cutting the aid to the South Vietnamese in half. And in the words of the victorious North Vietnamese general, published, I believe, on June 26, 1976 in the New York Times, it was those cuts in aid from the Congress, which he lists year by year, by fiscal years, with great professionality, which, in his words, broke the morale of the South Vietnamese, forced Thieu to lose his mobility, and make him, in the words of the North Vietnamese general, fight a poor man's war. And therefore, they decided they could safely violate the agreement of January 1973, because of what? Essentially, Watergate. No one can know whether if President Nixon had kept the integrity of that office and the prestige of that office, whether the guarantees he'd made in writing to Thieu to get the agreement, namely high levels of aid, and we would come back, presumably with air and naval forces, not ground forces, in case it was violated. But in any case, the story of the United States in that post-agreement period and the Watergate and its effects on the integrity of the office of the president and the convergence of movement in the Congress to, in a sense, destroy South Vietnam at a time when there was not one U.S. soldier there, not one plain naval unit, is a part of this story which we must also get over and surface and live with.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to just reinforce one or two points there. I, of course, didn't touch the pacification given, right, and that's what it was all about. And you're quite right. My own observation was that 69-70 was the high point of that. If there was a high point, it was in that period. It was very successful. I think the pessimism of the high Arvin official I mentioned and others had to do really with the military capability rather than that. And, of course, the Americans were gone by early 73, and I'm glad that you did bring out, which was not part of my brief, the 73-75 period, sometimes known as the indecent interval. Right, okay.
Right. My name is Murray Maverick,
sir.
And I'm a columnist of San Antonio newspaper, and during, I'm also a lawyer, and I don't speak for my newspaper in this regard, but during World War II, I represented more conscientious objectors than any lawyer in Texas. With that background, which I think I ought to tell you. During World War II, I'm a lawyer. My name is Maury Maverick. I'm also a newspaper man. During the Vietnam War, I represented more conscientious objectors than any lawyer in Texas. With that background, I want to ask you this question. You say the Vietnam War was our greatest failure of American foreign policy. Is that so? Because from the beginning, the Vietnam War was an immoral outrage, as some claim, or was it because we didn't bomb enough and kill enough and had these military constraints imposed on the military leaders in Vietnam, our own?
I'd say neither. What is my answer? I of course, move from things from the point of view of realpolitik, and I feel that it was a excessive expenditure of resources in an area that could never possibly pay off, and that if, in retrospect, we had the choice of rewriting history, it seems to me, obviously, the candidate for our support early on would have been the other side. But that was impossible because of the European connection of France and so forth, and the point that George brought out earlier about the tie-in with the Cold War. So therefore, Vietnam was sort of put as a footnote. I said the greatest failure of American foreign policy because I simply say from the amount of resources expended, and I'm not just talking about money, I'm talking about capital in terms of our society and things of that nature, for what conceivably could be gained out of it, by any cost-benefit basis, it was a loser. Right. Second, it was in fact a failure in terms of the final outcome. So I'm just talking from that point of view. Now, all things are relative. And what I said is it was the greatest foreign policy failure of our time, which is not to say that there weren't some well-meaning things about it, there weren't maybe some good things might have flown out of it and so forth. But as it worked out, can you think of another foreign policy failure of our time that would be greater than that? I can't. No, you're not disputing that. You're asking causation. I would straddle it by taking a realpolitik point of view. That's what I meant, if that's what you mean, what my interpretation was. That was it. You know. Although I don't deny what you say as having validity. I'm just saying that I didn't proceed from those premises.
Well, my point was that thousands of young people in this country, and I dealt with them.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They were making moral protests, and it was a moral question that you have to evaluate Vietnam on, and there's also a military question. I wasn't a general. I was a captain in the Marines, and so I don't know as much as generals do.
Well, that's the same as a general in the Army.
But a general, it's better.
Okay, you can't beat a Marine, right. Thanks.
The microphone.
Speak.
Should I go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Rod Davis. I'm with the Progressive Magazine, and you refer to a foreign policy failure, which I'm not sure if you mean also a military failure or not, because you made a statement I just wanted to ask you about. You said Tet, if I understood this, was a military and technological defeat for the NVA, but a psychological victory. Does that turn around to mean that it was a military and technological victory for the U.S., but a psychological failure?
No, I don't think exact analogies hold.
Well, my point is then...
It doesn't have to be either or, come on.
If it was a military and technical victory for the United States, what prevented us from turning that into a psychological victory?
Because the home base no longer existed. We had built up an image, I think, intentionally or otherwise, of an enemy that was essentially defeated. And, I mean, if you read the fine print, maybe we didn't say that. But the image created over a period of time was that this fellow was on the ropes. Now, what he did was intentionally fight a psychological battle in which he took enormous military losses, never expecting to win militarily, but expecting to impact on that third assumption that I mentioned of GIOPS about American public opinion.
This is the end of this tape. Discussion continues on 3B-48-82.